John offered, for it was indeed the question that had hit him the moment the screen had flickered to life and he was staring at that damned grinning Pac-Man.
Databases, Ernie replied. Lone computers like this Apple IIe are nothing but toys.
John was silent, not leaping to the defense of an old friend of a machine that had enabled him to write a master's thesis in near record time.
It was linking them together, the Internet back in the mid-90s, that truly launched the revolution. A machine alone, okay, it's entertaining, and kids can play that dang Pac-Man and Mario on it until the motherboard finally fries off, and the way this one is smelling, I don't give it very long unless I take it apart and clean it. I'm thinking about databases. Uplinks, for example. Those guys up in Bluemont don't tell me they don't have systems up and running. I'll assume the low-Earth orbit sats got killed off when the war blew, but the ones up at Geosync, I'd give my left... He paused, looking at Becca. Excuse me. I'd give my left arm to be able to tap into that data flow, and they don't know I've hacked in.
After mentioning losing an arm, seconds later, he realized the faux pas he had committed in front of Forrest, who had indeed lost an arm. He looked over at the veteran anxiously, and Forrest forced a smile.
At least it wasn't the arm I use for important things.
Ernie offered a weak grin of thanks. John, however, was looking at Ernie wide-eyed. Could you actually do that? Eavesdrop into Bluemont's comm system?
I already knew the story about Galileo, Professor Matherson, and yeah, maybe I could.
John looked over at Forrest, remembering the reason his friend, a former enemy, had ventured over the obstacle of the Mount Mitchell range in what was becoming a driving blizzard, with word that someone who had once served with his closest friend in the pre-war army had trekked 200 miles to eventually reach them. I'm giving you whatever gas you need, Ernie, to move whatever you want here to this basement. If you can get any of these machines up and running, do so ASAP. I'll put the word out in a town announcement for folks to start rummaging through attics and basements to see what can be found.
I'd advise against that, Forrest interjected.
Why?
We learned that our old bastard friend Fredericks had one or more people of his planted here. Let's assume the same. For now, I'd suggest keeping this nugget quiet and let's talk to that Quentin fellow first.
John took it in, hesitating.
Galileo, don't you think he regretted blowing his mouth off about his discovery? Forrest interjected. He should have stayed quiet a few years, done his research, gotten it out to a trusted few others. Instead, he invites the church officials in, and bango, he's on trial for heresy and under house arrest for the rest of his life.
John looked at his friend with surprise.
Hey, a lot of long nights when deployed, plenty of time to read history, same as you, even if I didn't get a fancy degree.
John smiled and nodded in reply.
Until this storm lets up, we'll focus on what Paul and Ernie are playing with, John said, though at this moment his thoughts were far more focused on who Quentin Reynolds was, if indeed Bob Scales was alive in Roanoke, and what portent that was for the future.
Chapter 2 It was 2 days before the storm finally abated, the morning of the second day dawning bright, clear, and still. John was up first, shivering as he pushed kindling into the wood stove, the sole source of heat for the house, watching it flare to life as the kindling ignited from the hot coals from the night before, and then carefully feeding in split lengths of seasoned hickory and oak. Memory of another time hit him every time he did this. His abandoned and burned-out home up by Ridgecrest had a fireplace. Of course, everyone wanted one when they moved to the mountains, and it was a source of comfort for Mary in her final days, wrapped in an old family quilt and nestled in an overstuffed chair pulled up close, John making sure the fire was blazing cheerily. The fireplace was purely psychological for Mary, though young Elizabeth, fed some propaganda in her middle school classes, would sniff, saying it was inefficient, polluted the atmosphere, and contributed to global warming. She was right on at least one point. The amount of heat generated when compared to the warm air sucked up the chimney all but equaled out. But there was something about crackling wood in the fireplace, the radiant heat striking a primal chord that just made one feel comfortable and content on a cold, snowy day.
Now it was different.
The wood was not delivered as it once was, by one of his neighbor's friends at $100 a truckload, at least somewhat seasoned and stacked by the back deck. During the first winter after the day, it had been a mad scramble for heat, any kind of heat, and more than a few had died. Not from freezing, though that did happen, but more often from pitching heart attacks while trying to hand-cut and then split firewood, complete to chopping down decorative dogwoods and cherry trees in the front yard. Long forgotten was the time when nearly every home and farmstead had its own woodlot of a couple of dozen acres, up on the side of a mountain slope too steep to be cleared for plowing or even grazing. Preparing for the next winter started even before the last snows of spring had melted off, and was why a farmer cherished having several sons, whose daily chore was to spend a few hours every day cutting down trees, bucking them down to stove length, splitting the stove-sized wood by hand, and stacking for curing, not just for warmth come next winter, but for daily cooking, heating water atop the kitchen stove for the occasional bath, all of it accomplished by hard labor. Gone, as well, was the essential knowledge of anyone 150 years back. Seasoned hickory and oak put into the fire would last through the night. Maple was easy splitting. Pine was good for a quick start-up fire, but didn't last for heat. Locust became fence rails. The now extinct chestnut could be burned, but also made excellent furniture. In a pinch, with the woodpile running low, unseasoned ash could be harvested and used, and if out on a cold, rainy day, one could carry some rolled-up strips of birch bark, which would burn like a torch to get an emergency fire going. Information essential for living, which nearly all had to relearn to survive. The Melton brothers, after months of back-breaking work, rebuilt a long-ago dam face while the rest of their family labored for weeks to shovel out the silted-up marsh behind the remnants of the dam. Dams long ago built to block off once bubbling mountain creeks often fell into eventual disuse as decades of summer storms and the floods of springtime thaws trapped hundreds of tons of silt, the narrow valley pond behind the dam turning into a marsh and then eventually abandoned. And besides, who needed a water-powered mill dam with all its labor and headaches when first steam and then a 20-horsepower electric motor could do the same amount of labor? In this new world, gradually being rebuilt, the Meltons were the first in the valley to actually get a water-powered sawmill up and operating just below Ridgecrest along the aptly named Mill Creek, because down its tumbling length there had once been a dozen small mills for woodcutting, grinding corn for, among other things, making mash for a still hidden nearby. They built it on a site where a great-grandfather had once run a similar mill, which, when the revenuers were not poking around, supplied mash to stills up and down the valley. Ernie and family tried to argue they now owned the land and had the surveyor plats to prove their modern legal argument. It had nearly turned ugly until John helped negotiate a deal that whatever logs Ernie dragged down to the Meltons with his old reliable Polaris off-road vehicle, the Meltons would cut up for free. And if a few mason jars were mixed in with the returned firewood as well, no further questions would be asked. The historian in John loved the sound of that mill, knowing he was hearing the echo of a long-ago age of water power, the creaking of the slowly turning water wheel, the rasping of the saw driven by the wheel, the redolent scent of fresh-cut wood and cool mountain water cascading over the water wheel. And although corn for actual food was still a national priority, in this, the third year of harvest since the start of the war, he was learning to turn a blind eye toward the thin columns of wood smoke rising up from nearby valleys and the occasional whiff on humid fall mornings of corn mash fermenting. He would ease his sense of duty with the thought that, as it was in the beginning, so it is again. Farther downstream, Paul Hawkins's team was waiting for the community of Old Fort to finish rebuilding what had been their original dam for a water-powered turbine so that he could set a generator in place and get the small community of survivors down there back online. The villagers of Old Fort, all but wiped out by the posse attack, planned to run a wire along Old Route 70 toward Marion and sell the power for trade items and food. In this, the third year since the day, an economic trading system was again back in place, and it did include white lightning brewed in remote mountain valleys, but now included much else as well. Those with foresight to stockpile some precious metals found they indeed had real worth again. In fact, by the standards of this terrible new world, they could be counted as wealthy, the silver and gold not just something to be locked away in a safe for just in case. Just in case had indeed arrived at last. Increasingly scarce was 22 ammunition, so that it was hardly on the trading market anymore, worth far more per round than the rabbit or squirrel it could put on the table. The weapons to be valued for hunting were the old flintlock rifles, once the realm of history buffs, reenactors, and muzzle-loading hunters. Lead salvaged from dead car batteries and saltpeter from manure pits provided two of the ingredients. Sulfur came from the old resort spa of Sulfur Springs down in Rutherford County, which long ago had provided the crucial element for gunpowder manufacturing from the colonial period and the Civil War. The Peterson family, old man Peterson, once a good friend of John from Civil War round table days, had set up the family business, which tragically killed his daughter and grandson, who had made a fatal mistake several months back out in the mixing shed, blowing up themselves and the entire building. There was even talk of scrounging up enough bronze or brass to make several small cannons for defense, a strange thought given the town had endured air attacks from Apache helicopters and now had a precious Black Hawk in their possession, a world of retro weaponry mixed with surviving remnants of a prior age. Beyond the trade in gunpowder from Rutherfordton and networking out to other communities struggling to come out of a dark age, a viable economic system was indeed emerging. It was not until after Fredericks's defeat that John had learned that, within Asheville, Fredericks had actually attempted to impose a mandatory confiscation of all silver and gold coins that had once been government minted. Unknown to those areas outside of Fredericks's brief period of control, he claimed a decree from Bluemont had ordered such, with a so-called fair trade of $100 in printed money for each silver dollar and $1,000 of paper money for each one-ounce gold coin. Only those caught with silver or gold on them complied under duress, meaning, "We caught you, give us the coins, here's your paper, now go and keep your mouth shut, or you are under arrest for illegal trading." Those thus caught referred to the paper as being not worth a damn Frederick, or to a more direct scatological reference as its only real use. Yet another troubling bit of information that had come to light after that vainglorious man's bloody defeat. The paper currency was even how those serving with the ANR had been paid. Those who had survived and surrendered after the battle to take out Fredericks were expecting execution, and thus were stunned by the offer to stay and join the community. All of them were young, generally in good health, thanks to the rations they had lived on for months, and were then divided up and assigned to different units within the State of Carolina's militia. There was some resentment for the first few days on the part of his own people, for, after all, over 30 from the town had been killed fighting against these young men and women. There had been one tragedy when a young man from the college murdered one of the ANR troops, blaming his victim personally for the death of his fiancée in the fight to take the courthouse in Asheville. It proved to be an extremely tense day, the nearly 100 ANR prisoners fearing that they had been lulled by John's promises and that Fredericks's warnings that to be taken alive by those mountain rednecks would mean torture, rape, and death. Some had gathered together, ready to fight or flee, when more than a few locals supported the young man's vengeance killing as justice, plain and simple. It proved to be just about the most difficult day John had ever faced. The community had yet to stand down from a state of military emergency. Therefore, John was deemed to be in command under military law. Reverend Black had insisted upon sitting on the tribunal since the accused came from the college where he now served as chaplain, rather than a civil trial since the crime had occurred while the community's troops were still in military service. Reverend Black, when he pronounced his vote with tears streaming down his face, startled everyone, declaring it had to be done, quoting Old Testament verses, that killing in combat was a tragedy that had haunted mankind from the beginning. But this death was cold-blooded murder, using the translation of murder rather than thou shalt not kill. John realized he had to carry out the sentence himself, as he had done with others. It could not be delegated, though he spent hours praying over it, hoping to find a personal way out. At the end, the young man took it stoically, forgiving John for what had to be done, and appealing to the dead man's friends for forgiveness as well. Memory of it, along with so many other memories, still woke him up in a cold sweat in the middle of the night. As to the regular army prisoners, especially the helicopter crews that had slaughtered many in Forrest Burnett's community, there had been outright calls to execute them. But John had had enough of executions, even though many, especially Forrest's community, which had endured the atrocity of being strafed by the pilot, cried for blood. In the end, John ordered them banished, pushed to the far side of the barrier on Interstate 40 at the top of the mountain and told to start walking. Chances they would survive a week were nil, and it was decided by all that the punishment was just. The after effect? The ANR survivors witnessed something they had never expected, even expressing regret for the entire tragedy and its end result, and thereafter no mention was made, at least publicly, of having been on one side or the other in the battle for Asheville. The ANR commanding officer, who had grown up near where John originally came from, now served as a platoon lieutenant in the militia, and what she and others had said about life outside of their valley added more fuel to his worries. All the ANR personnel had told him, along with reports by the BBC, served to fuel his suspicions and concerns about what exactly was taking place at Bluemont, and he was eager to get on the road to Forrest's community on the far side of Mount Mitchell. The fire within the stove was now crackling hot, radiating warmth. He remembered an old favorite author who wrote on Americana, Eric Sloane, his works filled with wonderful, detailed sketches of life long ago, stating that a wood fire heated you twice, from the labor it took to cut, split, stack, and haul the wood, and again when it finally burned as it now did before him.
All well and good, John thought with a smile. If one was young and 20 and had grown up with life being such.
There had been offers, which he always saw as little more than attempts at bribes, to provide him with wood and so many other things, but it was a point of honor that he worked and traded for it like everyone else. Before she passed, Jen, almost as if it were an afterthought, had revealed that there was a stash of several $100 of face-value silver filling half a dozen mason jars tucked away in a corner of the basement. When the government had gone over to clad coins back in the 60s, her husband, George, had denounced it as a damned conspiracy and had taken to emptying out the silver dimes, quarters, and occasional half dollars into a jar on his nightstand at the end of every day, and then stashing them in the basement when filled. The find had truly made them rich, and the historian inside of John had, of course, been fascinated by this first step back to a real money-based economy when he started offering a quarter here, a few dollars there for the essentials of survival. Silver and gold had disappeared from the economic flow long ago, and now finds like his were reintroducing them. Throughout the various communities that now made up the state of Carolina, there was hardly a basement or attic that had not been ransacked by surviving family members, and more than a few looters going at abandoned properties in search of such stashes. One such prowler, a drifter who had slipped in past the security posts guarding the approaches to Black Mountain, had been caught just a few months ago. Murder and rape were, of course, capital offenses, as was the case with one of his militia killing a former member of the ANR. Stealing food had been added to the list as one for which one could possibly face capital punishment. Some said it was little better than the obsessed policeman in Les Misérables hunting down a man who stole a loaf of bread. But after the starving times of that first winter, people did die for lack of a loaf of bread, or the pig they had been raising on scraps to provide meat for the winter suddenly disappearing. There was no jail in the town, except for an overnight lockup for the occasional drunk and disorderly. In such a time, to punish someone by locking them up in a warm jail, feeding them and then having to feed and compensate someone to watch over the offender was absurd. An infraction of stealing other than while mobilized for military service resulted in a civil court. If the theft was not crucial to the survival of a family or the entire community, the standard punishment had finally become a sentence to labor in the communal farmlands. Thus it was for that looter in search of a stash of gold or silver who labored for a month and then disappeared the night his sentence was completed. A supreme irony was for all those who had secured their precious metals in bank vault safe deposit boxes. With the failure of electricity, the vaults were automatically locked, sealed as tightly as some long-lost ancient tomb, owners of what some claimed were hundreds of ounces of gold, only able to stand outside the empty buildings and stare forlornly. John and the town council had even agreed to divert power into the old Fifth Third Bank on Montreat Road, a surviving employee then attempting to unscramble the locking systems, to no avail. Those standing outside watching the attempt, growing frustrated, started to suggest just blowing the entire thing up, which was, of course, vetoed. So the banks still stood, as did the other banks in town, the treasures within as remote as if lost in the hull of the Titanic. Inwardly, John breathed a sigh of relief, for if successful, there would have been a rush to crack into or blow up every bank in western North Carolina, and the flood of coinage pouring out, triggering that age-old nightmare of inflation. As for those who had purchased gold and went along with it being stored at a safe and secure location in Switzerland, they were truly out of luck. John sat by the open door of the wood stove for a few minutes, dwelling on all the events and changes taking place, willing to bet that Ernie had awoken the Hawkins family at dawn, tool bag in hand, ready to continue probing the computers found in the library basement. He watched the flames dancing, enjoying the radiant heat blossoming out, the fire, as it always does, weaving a hypnotic spell, the iron sides of the old stove cracking and pinging as they expanded from the heat. "How about some eggs and grits for breakfast?" He felt Michaela's warm touch on his shoulder and looked up at her with a smile. "Sure. But sit down with me for a few minutes first." She laughed, pulling her flannel robe in tight, revealing just how pregnant she truly was. "If I sit on the floor, it will take a forklift to get me back on my feet. Come on, I'll help you." With a groan, she sat down by his side and snuggled in close, extending her hands toward the glowing fire. "Sleep okay?" he asked while brushing a wisp of her golden hair back from her forehead and then kissing her. "Little badger must have woke me up half a dozen times. That baby wants out." He laughed and put a hand on her bulging tummy. He waited and a moment later was rewarded with a kick. Laughing, he kept his hand there and kissed her again. "Rishi'd wait a few more days before trying to get over the mountain," she announced. "It's still most likely snowing on the north slope, and the wind up there can kill. You ever read Jack London's To Build a Fire?" John smiled and nodded at the memory of a scoutmaster when he was a boy, getting the troop out of Newark and up to what at the time John felt was the true wilderness at High Point, New Jersey, for a 3-day winter survival trek. Shivering around the campfire at night, the scoutmaster had read that tale to his group of frozen city kids, most of them convinced their leader had gone crazy to drag them out on this trek. John remembered reveling in the adventure of it, all the time imagining that it was like being with George Washington's troops at Valley Forge or the midnight march through a blizzard to take Trenton. Romantic then, but Michaela did have a point. Temps could be 20 degrees colder up at the crest line at Craggy Gap, and though calm down here, it could be a 30 to 50 mile per hour blow up there. He had approached Billy Tyndall yesterday with the thought of using their Eronka L3 to fly him over the mountain range, a short 20-minute hop by air so he could meet this Quentin Reynolds, and Billy had replied with two words, "You're crazy." He then went on to a lecture about the killer weather conditions to be found around Mount Mitchell, pointing to an old FAA map of the region pinned to the wall of the makeshift hangar, where a specific warning was printed about the dangers of severe turbulence in the area. "You ask any pilot who's not crazy and thus still alive about flying around up there, especially in an old underpowered tail dragger, and they'll tell you that you are indeed crazy. We damn near got killed last time you and I flew there. It wasn't the bullets and Apache helicopters that scared me half as much as getting slammed by a downdraft and sending us right into the side of a mountain, so no way." so waiting for a crystal clear and very calm day was out.
It can't wait, John finally replied to Michaela.
Forrest said the guy was in bad shape. If he slips into pneumonia, he could be on the edge of dying unless we can get some of our antibiotics into him, and that alone is reason enough to at least try to get to him.
There's something about the name of this guy that rings a bell somewhere in my head, beyond the fact that he claimed to have served with my friend Bob Scales. I gotta go.
All right, help me get up. Eggs and grits, something to stick to your ribs.
John never could figure out the southern obsession with grits, but when one has gone through a starving time, the memory lingers.
Did I hear grits?
The two looked back to see Forrest coming out of the guest room, pulling up his suspenders over his shoulder, deftly doing so with his one hand. John stood up, helped Michaela get to her feet, pushed a few more split pieces of hickory into the stove to ensure a good long hot fire, and closed the door. A moment later, Michaela had the iron skillet resting atop the wood stove. She'd also set an old-fashioned percolating coffee pot filled with water, which was again coming out of a faucet tap thanks to the electrical pump that soaked up a significant part of the town's electricity, but again provided safe, clean running water to most homes, and another item of the past, ready to put in some chicory roots and an herbal concoction.
Oh, damn it, wait a minute.
Forrest sighed at the sight of the coffee percolator and disappeared back into the guest room. They both knew he had some, the scent of it as seductive as any perfume, and both of them had silently hoped he still had some left. Etiquette was never to ask people if they had a secret stash of some precious item like chocolate, honey, coffee, or cigarettes. One waited to be offered, and while visiting with John and Michaela, coffee, wherever it had come from, was part of breakfast again. After the meal, Forrest would step outside, at Michaela's orders, to enjoy his one cigarette, Michaela keeping a watchful eye on John so that he didn't break his vow to Jennifer. Forrest returned, and in his open hand he held out four small plastic K-cups, hazelnut, no less, fully caffeinated. Michaela all but snatched them from his hand. Along with rare 22 bullets and silver coins, the once ubiquitous K-cups had become a cherished trade item, the coffee within still fresh even 3 years later. Michaela carefully cut each one open, not letting a single grain fall to the floor, and emptied them into the percolator before putting it on the stove.
"Now tell me you got some of those creamer cups and packets of sugar and life will be complete," John interjected, breaking a golden rule of good manners.
Forrest smiled, reached into his pant pocket, and produced three of the creamer cups as well.
"Sorry, but sugar is out."
"Apologies for asking," John replied, but Forrest smiled.
"Who'd have thought those darn things would one day be worth so much?"
Within minutes, the grits were simmering atop the stove, and heaven of heavens, the scent of coffee brewing filled the room. The sound of the coffee percolating was a flashback to childhood, cold winter mornings, still dark outside, coming down to the kitchen, his father nearly finished with breakfast, letting John have a few sips of the warm brew before bundling up to take the train over to the gas plant in Harrison. It was a breakfast sound that disappeared with the advent of the Mr. Coffee machines, a sound he still missed, and all the other nuances of that time and place. His father's insistence on heavy cream and to hell with the cholesterol count, fresh bacon at least three times a week, or even the dreaded winter breakfast for kids, hot oatmeal with a slab of butter and perhaps a sprinkling of cinnamon. There was something about the quiet of breakfast time that triggered such nostalgia for John, particularly on a cold day, the sky a sparkling blue, the freshly fallen snow reflecting the morning light, the trees, especially the pines, still blanketed from the storm just past. John helped to set the table, appealing to Michaela to get off her feet while he placed a single egg on each plate, doled out the grits, and then carefully poured cups of coffee for each, as a proper host, shorting himself slightly while making sure the provider of such largesse had an extra gulp in his cup. Sitting, they joined hands, John reaching over to touch Forrest's empty left sleeve, said grace, and then wordlessly dug in, savoring each bite. Meal done, there was several minutes of silence, each one enjoying their cup of coffee while gazing out the window, until Forrest finally stirred.
Time to get going.
John nodded, helping Michaela to clear the table and clean the dishes in a pot of hot water that had been set atop the wood stove. Even now, after 3 years, people were still falling ill because of the lack of hot running water. The Saturday night bath was again a 19th-century ritual of heating water on the stove and standing in an old washtub, soap again a mixture of lard and wood ash and crushed mint leaves to at least create some kind of pleasant scent. John pulled on a tattered snowmobile suit that hung loosely on his lanky frame, followed by ski mask and gloves, and hoisted his emergency travel pack stuffed with winter survival gear, including a small tent, dry clothes rolled up inside a plastic bag, some dried beef jerky, and matches with a twisted-up piece of birch bark packed in a waterproof container. He picked up his M1 carbine, which had become his preferred weapon, checking to make sure it was cleared, holstered a Glock, and waited for Forrest to suit up in the guest room. Michaela looked at him anxiously. It was still all so ironic. They were only traveling 20 miles up over the Mount Mitchell Range and down to where Forrest's community had decided to remain, even though there was plenty of vacant housing in Asheville and right here in Black Mountain and Montreat. John had argued repeatedly with Forrest before winter closed in to move, but Forrest always rebuffed him, that he and his friends preferred to stay on the land that had once been their home. None of them were cut out for what he still sarcastically called city folk, and he did have the logical point that by staying north of the mountains, his community kept an eye on the northern flank of their world. The year before the day, several of John's students who owned jeeps had offered an adventure ride for his two daughters and himself, and it had turned into a day the girls adored, traversing fire roads and trails clear up to Mount Mitchell and back, soaking in the splendor of a sunlit autumn day. Now they were suiting up as if going into combat. There was still always a remote chance that perhaps some marauders following the old Blue Ridge Parkway were in the area and would gladly kill for Forrest's old Polaris 4x6. Forrest came out of his room wearing heavy winter camo, left sleeve cut off and sewn closed. A hunting rifle was slung from one shoulder, and a military-grade M4 taken in the fight with the ANR was slung around his neck and across his chest. "Ma'am, thank you for your hospitality," Forrest said, nodding politely to Michaela. Old mountain etiquette coming to the fore, extending his hand, giving her half a dozen K-cups, which she tried to refuse. John watching the exchange and, of course, inwardly hoping that the game would play out with Michaela reluctantly taking this incredible gift, which could mean coffee in the morning for nearly an entire week. "Take care of my husband," she finally replied, kissing Forrest on the cheek. He actually blushed slightly. He had long ago come to accept that his scarred, twisted face with one eye missing gave him a deadly-looking demeanor, and rare would be the woman who kissed him, even in a friendly gesture of politeness. "He can take care of himself, ma'am. Otherwise I wouldn't salute the son of a... bitch." "Yeah, can be that at times," she said with a laugh, and then turned and looked John straight in the eyes. "I know you've got to go, your damn sense of duty and all that, but, John Matherson, if you get yourself killed and leave me 7 months pregnant, I'll never forgive you." He looked around the room. More than enough firewood was stacked by the stove, the fire within radiating a comfortable glowing heat, augmented by the brilliant sunlight streaming through the sunroom window. If all went well, he'd be back by midday tomorrow. If all went well, something that in this world no one ever took for granted. They went down to the basement garage, the place where there had once been a lovely blue Mustang convertible, destroyed in the fight with the posse. The old, battered Edsel still ran, but was rarely used now since it was such a gas guzzler. When time again permitted, he planned to go into Asheville and prowl the abandoned automotive shops, finding a set of tires to match up with a 1958 Edsel. The tires on his nearly bald. The engine as well needed a major overhaul, and trying to find new rings and valves would be another challenge. They opened the garage door, and it took a minute for Forrest's open-air vehicle to start and keep running. John put his gear in the back well, double-checked the two jerry cans, making sure they were filled with gas, waited for Forrest to ease the vehicle out of the garage, closed the door behind him, and climbed into the open-air seat. Just sitting there made him doubt the wisdom of this trip. It was freezing cold. The old-fashioned thermometer next to the garage door mounted to a faded tin frame advertising the new 1958 Edsel registered 15 degrees. His wife was right. Chances were it would be below zero up over the pass. He tightened up his jacket, made sure no flesh was exposed, looked over at Forrest, and nodded. Let's go get Lee Robinson and hit the road.
Chapter 3
Still alive?
Forrest asked, looking over at John, who was shivering like the last leaf clinging to a tree in a hurricane, though John realized it might be that he was still scared witless. Going up the mountain range wasn't too bad, though the snow depth gradually increased. There was little wind. The sunlight was sparkling with such intensity that John cursed himself for not bringing along sunglasses. It was a journey through what he could only describe as a world out of the old tourist calendars that used to be sold in town of the splendor of the Black Mountains on a winter day. Pine and spruce branches were bent low under the weight of snow, forming tunnels along the old fire road as they crept up toward Craggy Gap. But, as they neared the summit, harsh reality suddenly closed in. The pass at Craggy was concealed by low scudding clouds racing up the north slope of the mountain range, gaining the Blue Ridge Parkway for a short run westward to the paved road that led down to Forrest's community. They drove into a true whiteout. Visibility barely beyond the front hood of the Polaris. The unrelenting wind had stripped the trees bare of snow, to be replaced with a thick coating of rim ice that actually stuck out horizontally from the bent-over branches. The roadway itself was blown nearly bare of snow, but around the first bend they encountered a 6-foot drift, created under the lee of a cliff. Forrest actually sped up, laughing as he plowed into it, John and Lee both cursing him, Forrest with but one hand clutching the steering wheel while shouting for John to shift the vehicle into four-wheel low drive. They nearly stalled out and then broke through, a few seconds later skidding sideways down the ice-covered road until they hit a patch of snow and thus gained traction again. At least the parkway was two lanes wide with crash barriers to stop them from tumbling into a gorge, but once off the parkway and onto a paved road that led down the north side of the mountain, John felt his nerves beginning to snap. The road was a series of ice and snow-covered switchbacks, the clouds lifting enough to reveal the terror ahead.
"We'd better think this one over," John cried, but Forrest, laughing, just hit the gas.
It was a long, white-knuckled toboggan ride of several miles, speed building up, John convinced they were going to crash or flip, Lee cursing madly from the back seat, but just when death seemed inevitable, Forrest would shout for John to shift to gear, and the Polaris would skid around a curve, straighten out, and then descend toward the next switchback. John realized that the twisted-up, battle-scarred veteran was one of those types that, after coming so close to death, had just simply lost his fear of it and even enjoyed challenging and taunting it, the adrenaline far more addictive than any drug or booze. They finally reached level terrain, Forrest skidding to a stop and without comment getting out of the Polaris to relieve himself by the side of the road.
"You crazy bastard!" Lee shouted. "You could have killed us all back there, and for what?"
"Afraid of dying?" Forrest asked, looking back with a sardonic smile at Lee. "We're alive. We had a hell of a rush. What more could you ask for?" "I'm walking back," Lee muttered, looking over at John, who was shaking so hard he could barely unzip his ice-coated snowmobile suit to relieve himself as well. 5 more miles from here, we'll take the fire lane over there. Cuts the trip in half and saves on gas. At least the last few miles were somewhat more tranquil, except for one steep pitch turn, John hanging onto the roll bar overhead to maintain balance while looking down at a ravine to his right that dropped 50 feet or more, where he saw poking up out of the snow at the bottom the wreck of a long-ago lost jeep. "That one killed a cousin of mine 5 years back," Forrest announced casually. "Freaked out that his fiancée had broken their engagement. He got liquored up and went out night-hunting for deer, missed the turn, and went over the cliff. He always was a stupid bastard. took 2 days to find him, and we just decided to leave the Jeep there as kind of a memorial.
Crazy must run in the family,
Lee grumbled. At last they came out to a paved road, and suddenly the land looked familiar, the exact same spot where Forrest and his community were camped when they had taken him prisoner back in the spring. Smoke wafting up and streaming away from a stove rigged up inside the community firehouse promised warmth. The ragtag array of old RVs and camping trailers ringed in tightly around the firehouse, which was the community center. Why these people still elected to stay here again filled John with wonder. Half a dozen miles away, there had once been a luxury resort of million-dollar vacation homes, complete with its own airstrip, all of it abandoned. He could see their side of it, though, for this, after all, was their land going back 150 years or more. Forrest and his friends had grown up in these valleys, knew every trail, and though game was all but completely hunted out along the south slopes of the mountains, over here a skillful hunter, especially when tracking in winter, could still find deer and bear, as clearly evident by the 2 bucks, gutted and skinned, hanging up outside the fire station. Forrest pulled up in front of the fire station, a small crowd of well-wishers coming out to greet him. John recognized more than a few, former enemies who had joined their side in the confrontation with Fredericks. There were polite handshakes, a few inquiring as to his wife and her health, and thanks for the help she had extended when so many had been injured. John peeled off his ice-covered ski mask, unable to conceal that he was still shaking, and someone immediately led him into the fire station, an elderly woman shouting for the crowd to let him warm up while she handed out hot mugs of, what else, yet more coffee, which, though scalding hot, John downed in several long gulps, sighing with relief, luxuriating in the warmth within the building. "How's our guest doing?" Forrest asked. His question was greeted with silence, and John felt a wave of dread. The old woman who had handed him coffee finally spoke up. "He died during the night." "Son of a bitch," Lee sighed, looking over at John, who sat down, shaking his head. "We should have gotten him to the hospital," Forrest finally said. "But with the storm coming on—"
His voice trailed off into silence. "Have you buried him yet?" John asked. The old woman shook her head and nodded to a side room of the fire station. John stood up and followed her while unzipping his snowmobile suit. Being inside felt stiflingly hot after so many freezing hours to get to this futile conclusion. He inwardly cursed. If Forrest only lived next to I-26, they could have easily transported him in a truck down to Asheville before the storm set in. The old woman opened the door, and John felt a slight wave of nausea. How his wife ever handled the daily exposure to all the scents of a hospital ward was beyond him. It smelled like a sick room, and he wondered if there was the first faint whiff of decay in the air. The body still rested on the bed the poor man had died in, covered by a sheet. John drew the sheet back. No matter how many times he had seen the face of death, it still struck at him. It was said that pneumonia was the old man's quiet friend, but it was obvious that the final hours must have been a terrible struggle. The man's face was contorted, eyes still open, features ashen gray. "I'm sorry. I should have taken care of him, washed and laid him out proper before I let you in here," the elderly woman escorting him whispered, and she reached over with gentle fingers to close the dead man's eyes, and tried to wipe away the grimace, though rigor mortis had already set in. "I know this man," John sighed, gazing intently. "I remember him from the war college. I think he was on my friend's staff." John pulled up a chair and sat down as Forrest and Lee came into the room. "I knew him," John said again. "Not well, just one of those staff types, always standing a few feet behind and to the side of a general." He struggled to dredge up more of a memory. The world before the day was filled with so many memories, so many of them now hazy, distorted, washed over and replaced by the trauma of the last 3 years.
The dead man before him was one of thousands of memories. Perhaps they had sat in on a conference together, maybe shared a drink with others. Wasn't there a military history conference at the War College where he had given a lecture? If so, it wasn't noteworthy enough to remember right now, and that in itself struck him as tragic. Another life had disappeared. Who and what he was, John could barely remember. Did he have a family still alive that treasured him and would want to know his fate? Did he have any papers, military ID, anything like that on him? Forrest shook his head. No wallet, nothing. The guy was pretty well beaten up when we found him. Muttered something about getting jumped by marauders on the far side of the pass for Interstate 26. He had several busted ribs, a lot of bruises, cracked jaw, and nearly out of his head when Forrest brought him in, the old woman said, and as she spoke she gently reached out to smooth the man's hair back from his forehead, a maternal gesture that touched John. Janet here was a nurse. You remember her sister Maggie, who took care of you when you first came to visit us? Forrest said. Visit. John smiled at that. When he was captured, with a busted rib as well, Maggie was the first person to show him sympathy. Maggie was gone, killed in the airstrike back in the spring. Your sister was an angel, John said. And thank you for seeing to this man. Did he say anything to you about how he got here and why? Not much I could understand. He kept asking for you, sir. Said he had served with a friend of yours, Bob Scales. There was a sudden leap of hope. On the day, John had actually been talking to Bob, who had called because it was Jennifer's 12th birthday. In the final seconds of that conversation, Bob began to cut the friendly chat short, his tone changing, saying, "Something is going on here," and then the connection went dead. For nearly 3 years now, he'd wondered what had happened to his old friend. Was he still alive? Did the man lying on the cot know the answer? And perhaps even more important, why had he come here? Had served with Bob Scales? And John hesitated. Or was now serving? I'm sorry, sir. He kept drifting in and out. Janet, it's John. Please. Now try to remember everything he said. Forrest left the room and returned a moment later carrying a couple of folding chairs, deftly opening them. "Could we leave the room?" Lee whispered. John looked back at his friend and could see that Lee, with a stomach even weaker than his, was getting queasy. Janet nodded in agreement and drew the sheet back over the body, and Forrest motioned for them to head into another room. The three men stripped off their winter gear, Janet coming in a few minutes later bearing 4 cups of coffee, black. "I'm sorry, but I gotta ask, and hope I'm not being impolite," Lee said. "You guys always have coffee. How?" Janet looked over at Forrest, who, in spite of the gravity of the moment, actually chuckled. "I always said don't ask, don't tell, but this time, okay, I'll spill. We found an abandoned truck gone off a ravine up near that rich folks' resort you keep wanting me to move into. The dang truck was loaded with cases of these K-cups, cases of them. Sorry, I kind of forgot to tell you about it." There was a tense moment of silence. There was an understanding among all that finds that could help the entire community should be shared. But it was not mandatory. The few who had tried to press the issue as an actual statute once the initial state of martial law was over with were denounced as thinking like commissars. Medical supplies, a truckload of preserved meat or canned fruit that children needed and such were one thing, but tens of thousands of K-cups? "Finders keepers," John finally replied, and Forrest visibly relaxed. "Sorry, John. There were 50 cartons of high-class cigarettes in there as well." "Don't even mention those," John replied sharply, not even wishing to contemplate his struggle with that addiction that still haunted him. For like nearly all ex-smokers, years could pass, and yet still the urge to try just one could hit. The only thing that kept him straight was his promise to Jennifer. John looked over at Janet, who was sipping her coffee. "Try to sort through it all, even the trivial, which might be really important. Like I said, he was brought in here badly beaten up,
half-frozen to death, frostbite to fingers and toes. If he had survived, he might have lost those anyhow. 3 ribs staved in. Wondered that his lung wasn't punctured. That injury was certainly no help when it came to the pneumonia already setting in. Cracked jaw as well, which made it even harder for him to talk and understand what he was saying. Fever was up over 102 when I got to him. No way to check blood oxygen level, but I could tell it was dropping. I was praying you'd get back with some antibiotics, but by last evening I knew he was over the edge. He slipped into a coma and died at around midnight.
What exactly did he say? John asked, pressing for something, anything.
He came somewhat clear for a brief period just before slipping into a coma. I've seen that happen before. Said to tell you that you've got to get to General Scales up in Roanoke and stop them.
She hesitated, looking to the door as if to make sure no one else was listening.
He said, EMP might be on the table.
What? Were those his exact words?
EMP is on the table,
Janet said. Whose table? John interjected, leaning forward, eager for an answer.
He never said who, what, or when. Was he remembering how the war started, talking about now or the future? I kept trying to gently prod him when he was conscious, but like I said, he was feverish and pretty well out of his head when he was brought in. I think if he had been out in the open even a few more hours, he'd have died from exposure and would be lying under the snow rather than in the next room.
John wearily shook his head and sipped his coffee.
Anything else? Please try to remember his precise words, ma'am. Just that you, John, had to get to a General Scales.
Was he talking like General Scales was a memory from the past?
I think I recognize Quentin. We might have served together while at the War College. Was he talking like that, rambling about our past, or that I had to see him now?
There was far more to this for John than just the urgency of a question about a garbled message from a dying man. If Quentin was speaking in the present tense, that meant that Bob Scales, one of his closest friends from before the war, was still alive, a prospect that could profoundly impact his responsibilities as a leader of his community. It meant a respected and beloved friend had somehow survived the day. He had heard about the reports on the BBC that Virginia had been pacified by forces of the regular army. Was Bob the general in command? Janet was silent for a moment, obviously carefully going over her memories.
Forgive me. I should have had a notepad with me and written it all down as he spoke. I'm sorry.
Don't blame yourself, Janet, he replied, though inwardly he wished she had indeed done just that, for memory of a conversation with a dying man that one was trying to nurse at the same time could indeed become garbled.
There was something, she sighed. Again, I'm sorry. I should have written it down as he was whispering to me. He rambled about going to Roanoke. Find Bob there, or something like that.
John looked over at Forrest and Lee, who were taking it all in, but wisely were remaining silent.
I got to add, maybe call it a perspective. Sometimes he was talking as if it was before the war, kept saying he had to get his wife and kids out. When he talked of them, he would cry. It was terrible to see him like that. Poor man was such a tortured soul.
Who isn't? Lee said softly, gazing out the window.
He said something about looking up H.G. Wells's epitaph, that the guy was right and will be right again.
Why would he mention H.G. Wells's epitaph? John wondered. He had read Wells as a kid, but all he could remember was The War of the Worlds and an old movie, Shape of Things to Come. Wells wrote the script for back in the 1930s, predicting the coming of World War II.
And you checked over everything he had on him?
John asked.
Everything. Forrest and I stripped him down to check for injuries. He was in military fatigues, but no winter overcoat, weapons. Something about the marauders after taking him had stripped him down and joked they were going to sell him.
She paused.
You know, there are still some hideaway groups out there that won't hesitate to take someone as food.
John nodded.
Fragments of groups like the posse were still out there in remote valleys and on mountaintops. They had learned to stay clear of his communities, but like jackals, they did linger on out on the fringes of a slowly re-emerging civilized world. What he still had on was soaking wet. We stripped him down and found no paperwork or anything like that. All we could do then was to bundle him into warm blankets, give him aspirin and a few shots of moonshine, and hope for the best. I told Forrest to fetch you. The poor man kept saying you were the one he had to speak to. Sorry, but that is all that I can tell you. Whatever answers he had, rest now with his soul.
John stood up and went back into the temporary morgue, respectfully pulling the blanket back to gaze at the battered corpse as if somehow an answer would emerge, or, like Lazarus, he might rise up to return and tell thee all. He sat by the body for several minutes, the others not entering the room, as he gazed at the mortal remains of a major he could barely remember. The dead offered him no answers, just silent wondering. He covered the body and returned to the room where his friends waited in silence.
Forrest, can we get home before dark?
Forrest sighed and nodded. Chapter 4
So that's it, John said, leaning back in his chair after reciting the adventure of the previous day and the mystery it now presented. The small office was crowded. Representatives of the Senate, for what they defined as the state of Carolina, packed into the room. The body heat from so many people, along with the wood stove, made the room hot, the scent of the air all but overpowering with its warm, musky smell of unwashed men and women. The long-ago paintings of the Founding Fathers gathered in debate made them always look all so clean. He now understood far better why old films would at times show an effete French or English nobleman daintily holding a scented handkerchief to his nose. With the onset of winter, even the weekly bath had become a laborious chore. Michaela was one of the few who still insisted upon a Saturday night bath for both of them, and during the summer a skinny-dipping jump into Flat Creek on a near-daily basis, even though it was freezing cold throughout the year. But at least in the summer they could lie out in the backyard to sunbathe and wistfully talk about a day to come with electricity restored, when they might even scavenge up an old jacuzzi and somehow get it running again. Most had reverted back to the 19th-century practice of putting on long johns when the cold weather set in and not taking them off until spring arrived. John often wondered if the founders had smelled as bad. Hard to picture the brilliant Jefferson or Washington himself smelling like those gathered in the room, even when at Valley Forge. He tried not to breathe deeply, but Michaela, who was impervious to such things, noticed his discomfort and cracked a window open, letting a gust of frigid air into the room. A few shifted uncomfortably, but others nodded a thanks.
"I've reached a decision as to what I think we should do, or, to be more precise, what I should do," John said. "But we are no longer under martial law. It will require significant resources, therefore it is up to you."
"It's precious little information to make any kind of decision on," Reverend Black said, starting off a debate that John feared might run for hours. "A stranger who you think you recognize wanders into our region, claims he wants to talk with you regarding something that involves an old army friend of yours."
"Yes, that's basically it."
Black sighed. "When a man's time is drawing to a close, he often drifts back years, decades. A good friend of mine, a colonel during the Second World War, climbed out of bed the night before he died and started to wander about the hospital corridor, yelling at the staff to put their helmets on and get ready because a bonsai charge was coming in. The poor guy had to be restrained. He kept yelling and cussing at everyone, this from a man who until his final days you never heard a foul oath from." Black smiled wistfully. "It was good old soldier cussing at its best."
Forrest chuckled softly. "I can teach some new ones any time you want, preacher."
Black gave him a bit of a baleful glance, but then smiled. Even the way he was talking, the turns of phrases sounded like something from an old movie rather than the way we talk today. "My point,"
He was back in 1944 up until the moment his last breath slipped out of him, with me holding his hand and praying by his side. His last words, though. Black's voice faded to a whisper, and he was obviously struggling to hold back on his emotions. His last words. Let us cross over the river and rest under the shade of the trees. That put a lump in John's throat. Stonewall Jackson's last words, he said softly. Precisely my point, Black replied. He was in a different time and place, perhaps remembering that quote from a class in West Point when he was still a plebe. I think it might be the same with this poor, tragic Quentin. Therefore, John, I have serious doubts as to anything he said. Tell A.P. Hill he must come forward, Lee Robinson interjected. John looked over at his friend and nodded with understanding. What? Ernie asked. Some of the last words of both Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, John said. They were back on the battlefield calling for a trusted general to bring his troops into the fight. So the whole thing could be a hallucination? Ernie asked.
It could be, John replied.
Then take it as such, John. We've got way too many other things to worry about.